Shoftim Perek Yud, chapter 10. So, you think you've left Gideon and Abimelech in the rearview mirror. But the answer is you have not. Well, killing them doesn't mean they're dead.
They're over. They're dead.
The zombie Shoftim. They're going to keep on coming back. We're not done with them. Brief review, Prakim 6 to 9. We saw oppression by Midian. We saw redemption. Well, it actually began with rebuke by Pinchas coming to them and telling them, you know, you're doing things that are terrible. We were oppressed by Midian, redeemed under Gideon, encouraged by the miracles that demonstrate each step of the way that God is going to be with him, even as God demands of him that he go out on a limb. After the war, there is strife between them, as there are those who say, why didn't you take us with you? There are those who aren't willing to support Gideon. They're worried that by supporting Gideon, they put themselves at a disadvantage if Midian comes back into power. We saw the descent after Gideon's time into idolatry. And then we saw Abimelech. Abimelech being Gideon's son from a concubine, who has his 70 or 69 out of 70 half-brothers killed. One of them, Yotam, survives and offers a rebuke. But Abimelech becomes the leader in Shechem and possibly surrounding areas. And then God creates bad blood between Shechem and Abimelech, in which they end up attacking each other. First, there's a rebellion against Abimelech. Abimelech is brutal in crushing and killing the citizens of Shechem and Migdal Shechem, and then he goes to war against Tebates, and he gets killed in his war against Tebates when a millstone is dropped from a building on his head, leading Ralbag to say, just general piece of advice, if you're laying siege to a town, don't stand near tall buildings. Okay, that was the end of the saga of Gideon and Abimelech. But as I said, it ain't over. If you take a look on your sheet, you see the structure of the 10th parak. Very appropriate for the weather. The parak is going to begin with just two psukim about a shofet by the name of Tola ben Pua. Ring a bell? Anybody ever hear of Tola ben Pua? Okay. Right, Shifra and Pua, that's with an ayin. This Pua is with an aleph. Otherwise, though, it would work. Sorry? Tola eretz al blima. Different word. Al blima, but in any case, that's a hay at the end. Yeah, sorry. It is points for the Yom Noraim Dominic. Right. So we have two psukim regarding Tola ben Pua. Then we'll have three psukim that will involve Yair HaGiladi, the next shofet, before we bring in the a rehashing of the shoftim spiral and how the Jews sin and how God brings the nation of Ammon to attack them, and he rebukes them, and they are rehabilitated, and then they get a new shofet whose name is familiar probably, and his name is Yiftach. And his story comes after that, and his story, and of course his daughter's story along with. So initially when I was looking at this parak, it looks like it's sort of an interlude. It's not really so significant in its own right. It's sort of bridging the gap between the big names of Gideon and Abimelech on one side and Yiftach and then Shimshon on the other side. So here we get a little bit of filler. And that's the way that Professor Elie Tzur in the Dot Mikra edition takes it. But then I was working on it further, and then I found an article by a Dr. Yisrael Rosenson, quite by accident, and he gave me a different perspective on it, which I think works very well in terms of where this fits into the course of the Sefer as a whole. And it gives new meaning to what happens with Gideon and Abimelech. So, first things first. The general themes in this parak are basically the national descent into idolatry picking up steam, as we'll see. And these two shoftim who really don't seem to have very interesting careers, or at least if they do, the book isn't aware of it.
Did they ever ascend before from the last one? Did they get back into the thing and now they're descending again? Or
did they
never really came out?
Never really came out. Nope. No, we're in trouble. So Dat Mikra, again, takes the view that this is an interlude that plays a certain structural role. Take a look at source number one, please, from Professor Elitzur. In the Dat Mikra, he says, "Shoftim manhigim rabim amdu lahem li Yisrael betkufa shebein ha-hitnachalut levein reishit ha-melucha." He says there were many judge/leaders who stood for Israel in the era between when we settled the land, right under Yehoshua, and the beginning of the monarchy in Sefer Shmuel. But we only get details about some of them in Shoftim. Remember, this goes back to what we discussed in the introduction to this series, way back, well, I know when, 32 weeks ago, when we talked about two different views, with a summer in between, we talked about two different views regarding, in general, what a Shoftim is and how this book records them. You had Abarbanel, who says the Shoftim that exist are the ones who are in the book. And they're all righteous, and they're wonderful leaders, and all of that. Avimelech being a question mark. But on the other hand, Professor Elitzur from the beginning has insisted that no, there are Shoftim. There are a great variety of Shoftim. There are many of them. They're regional rather than national. Some of them are great. Some of them are not so great. And as he says here, not all of them even make it into the book. This gives us some kind of a sample of the Shoftim. El Nachon Bachar Kosev HaSefer Ba'osam HaShoftim Shebema'aseihem Bekoroseihem Ba'af Bekishalonoteihem Yesh Mishum Lekach Ledorot. He says, correctly, in his opinion, the author of the book chose judges whose actions and events and even mistakes could provide lessons for generations. But just like we say in the Gemara and Megillah regarding Nevuah, regarding prophecy, that there were thousands upon thousands of Nevi'im, but Tanakh records for us the ones who relate to our time. When the process of canonization takes place, they say, what do we really need in Tanakh? And they drop those things that don't have relevance across time. That's their assessment. So he says that's what's happening in Shoftim. Lumat halalu, ein ha-kasuv ma'arich b'shoftim shelatamo shakosev ha-sefer lo haya b'karoseihem mishum tasepet leka u'mishum goven chadash miuchad. He says, and on the other hand, the text does not go on at length when it's dealing with Shoftim, who, in the opinion of the author, don't present a whole lot to teach us. In other words, if you don't get a lot of text in the book, it's likely because there's nothing for us to learn. In other words, we could talk about, in his view, Tola ben Pua and how, you know, he set up a school, or he, you know, took care of the people who were struggling with a famine, or he fought this war. But honestly, we know about wars already, and we know about the basic system, and it wouldn't teach us much. So therefore, it's not mentioned. Well, then that raises a question, which is why mention them at all? So why throw Tola ben Pua into this book? So he says, "V'yesh mehem shakasa b'sefer shoftim maskir b'shmam umodi ala dosehem kama pratim b'kitzur." Some of them, the book actually mentions their names and tells us about them a few details in brief. Yitachin shenahag kosev ha-sefer kach kedei shtei t'munas ha-tkufa shlema yosef. He says it could be that the reason for this is because you want to present a complete picture of the period. So that the reader will know, yes, there were many Shoftim from a bunch of different tribes. So in other words, if he had left out Tola, Yair, and all those like them, so we would know about Devorah, we would know about Gidon, we would know about Abimelech, we would know about Yiftach and Shimshon, but even from the beginning of the book, like maybe he would have left out Osniel ben Kenaz. Shem and Gera, he would have had to leave in, because that's a cool story. But yeah, we'd leave out Ibtan, who we'll see later on. Sorry? There was Shamgar ben Anat, right, with the cattle goad. So some would be left in, some would be left out, but the result would be an impression that all your Shoftim are people with these great stories. So therefore you include some who don't have stories, to show some sense of the variety. And then last he says, this is kind of funny, but he just throws it in at the end. The achron achron, last but not least, kedei shelo yehachu advarim ekev ofyom haselektivi lemein leket parashios ketuos. He says, you want the story to become, because of the selected personalities, this kind of anthology of abbreviated passages. So it sort of helps with the flow of the book. It's not monotonous, it's like, here's this, and then up, and then like that. And
is this in order then? Are we saying chronologically this is in order?
At this stage, it does seem to be in order. Correct.
Why don't we put Root in the middle here?
Why don't we put Rose in the middle of this book? Because I think we want Rose to have her own book because of the whole connection to David. Right? I think because of the lineage of David HaMelech, it sort of has to stand on its own.
When did it happen?
So that's a good question. We know it's during this period at some point, and the Medrash will link Ivtzan, who we'll see later, as Boaz. So that gives us potentially a sense of it.
Who is Boaz?
Boaz, as in Boaz from Rose?
No.
Ivtzan. We haven't seen him yet. But blink and he'll be gone when we do see him. Okay. But that's why. I think because it has its own sort of standalone significance. In other words, all right, go back to your question. I think that in Shoftim, sort of, the theme is the descent of the Jews who went native among Canaan. Whereas the theme of Rus is an entirely different theme. It's trying to give me a completely different message and doesn't really fit the theme of the book. Whether you're going to say it's teaching me about Rus as the Gioras, or whether you're going to say it's teaching me about Chesed and the mitzvos of gleaning and all that, or whether it's teaching me about David, none of those are part of the theme of this Sefer. This Sefer is, I told you not to be like Canaan, and you did it anyway. That's what this really is. So Rus really deserves to have its own
such
treatment.
A good book. Like, that's
yeah. No, this is not a friendly book. Right? Rus is nice. We can teach Rus to kids the bat mitzvah. They can give a nice tour Torah. They can feel good. Like, you don't want to give them this. Why they all kill each other, mommy?
You know, it all goes kind of in order.
So this is an order anyway. That's a repetition.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's all the dot mikra version. But then, what I was actually doing was I was writing up this first source, number one, which, because it's in the Dot Mikra, which is not available online, I'm sitting there retyping it. Mm-hmm. And then I said to myself, you know, maybe somebody in an article somewhere actually, you know, used this, and then I can just cut and paste it from the article. I still translate it, but at least I get that. And lo and behold, the one person who had taken a piece of this was this fellow, Dr. Yisrael Rosenson. He's a professor. I think Hebrew U, but I'm not sure. It might be Bar Ilan. And he writes an introduction to the story of Yiftach, in which he presents a perspective which is just fascinating. And his perspective is that there's actually important information going on in this period with Tola and Yair, and it's about the flow from Gidon and Avimelech first into Yiftach. And the point of this is going to be that the Jews don't learn the lessons that they should be absorbing from what happened with Abimelech. And we'll see. I'm going to play this out over the parrot. Sorry. Exactly. No, but that's exactly the point.
From the beginning, they haven't learned their lessons.
Right, but no, there are specific things they should learn from what happened with Abimelech, and they don't pick up on, which are going to be important also for broader themes within the book, like our approach to monarchy, for example. As we'll see.
And again, I'm sorry about my question.
Why are you sorry? This is good.
Because I keep interrupting.
I get to breathe.
The people, again, that were just fighting him, the Shechem, everyone that was involved with Abimelech, were they the Jews? What did we say again? Because if we're not sure, then why would we say that the Jews didn't learn their lesson from this when maybe they weren't even involved in the story in the first place?
Right, because there are Jews involved in the story. The only question is how many of these different players are Jewish and how many are not, meaning there are Jews among the citizens of Shechem. That's very clear. Whether they are the Baalei Shechem to whom Ahimelech appeals, saying, you're my family from my mother, or whether they're just the people in general who supported him and ended up in this mess, is not clear. But we know for sure the Jews follow the Avodah Zarah of the ephod that Gidon made. There it said Yisrael specifically. So there are Jews in that story. The only question is what percentage of the people involved are Jewish. Are there players who are not?
Right, and that's very localized. You know, does it involve?
And we don't know. We just know that he has a broader take than just Shechem, because it said by Yasar al Yisrael, but we didn't know how far that actually went. Okay. So with this in mind, Dr. Rosenson in source number two, right? He says, Mikomam Basefer, their place in the book, meaning Tola and Yair, their place in the book, Matim Lumakomam Behistoria, suits their place in history. Vahaleka Hanoman Bimasehem, Matim Lumakomam Zeh, and the story that we learn from their deeds fits this place in the book. Nitan lishol. We could ask, Ata manuchal lasik miseder zeh. What exactly is it that we're supposed to learn from this order? Ha'im tola v'yair shechayu u'po'alu miyad acharei avimelech lamdu v'yismu et halakachim shal sipuro. Did Tola and Yair, who lived and functioned right after Avimelech, did they learn and apply the lessons of his story? V'ha'im Yiftach sheshafat miyad achareihem hefik lakach mikarot chayem. And did Yiftach, who reigns right after them, does he succeed in drawing lessons from their lives? So that's really what this is about. They are critical to what is an overarching arc within the book. As a matter of fact, I said this at a different class. It gives me a new perspective on the structure of Sefer Shoftim altogether. Meaning, go way back in your memory, the first two chapters of the book were not about particular Shoftim, but instead were an introduction to the first 120 to 160 years of Shoftim, in which we were told about the Jews' attempts to conquer, and Yehuda went first, and then this one went, and then they stopped conquering, and instead they took tribute from the Canaanim, and then they weren't even taking tribute from the Canaanim, they were living as a minority among the Canaanim. And then, in Perek Bet, in chapter 2, along comes a Navi, who we took to be Pinchas, because anybody in this book who doesn't have a name is Pinchas. So Pinchas, no, there were reasons, but anyway, Pinchas rebuked them for not doing what they were supposed to do and warned them that they were going to suffer for it. And then we launched into the stories of the Shoftim going back to the beginning from after Yehoshua died. So that story, we said at the time, really takes place at the end of the fifth parak, beginning of the sixth, at the after Devorah. Because you can't rebuke the Jews for not conquering Canaan in the very beginning, because they're not strong enough. The first time the Jews are strong enough to beat Canaan is when Devorah and Barak lead them over Canaan in their war in chapters 4 and 5. So what we said was, chapter 1 through chapter 5 is a unit. It's the beginning. It's getting the strength to actually conquer Canaan, and then failing to do so and being rebuked for it. Right after that was the start of the Gideon story. Gideon was chapter 6, 7, 8. Abimelech was chapter 9, and a very memorable chapter it was. And that's this arc of leadership leadership that first under Gideon does not want to be king, and then Abimelech does want to be king. And then we have the results of that play out in the stories of here, Tola and Yair, and then Yiftach, and then Shimshon. And that's going to be the central part of the book. Because once you're done with Shimshon, all you have left are those two stories at the end, the idol of Micha and Pilagish Begiva, which represent the ultimate descent. So in other words, the way to look at it is your opening part of the book is really everything up through Devorah. Your central part of the book is Gideon through Shimshon, and then you have your last two stories that demonstrate just how terrible the nation has become. But that's I think a good way to look at the Sefer as a whole. Now that we've bridged together Gideon, Abimelech, and Yiftach and Shimshon. So keep it in mind. I realize it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense yet, but once we read their stories and see what the lessons are they're supposed to learn that they don't get, I think it'll become a lot more clear. Credit to Dr. Rosenson. Okay. So, Tola ben Pua. Let's take a look at the opening couple of psukim here. And that will give us a stronger sense of this. Vayakam achrei Avimelech loshia es Yisrael Tola ben Pua ben Dodo ish Yisachar. So, and arose after Avimelech to rescue Israel, Tola son of Pua. Now, the next words after Tola son of Pua, what do you have?
Son of Dodo.
Son of Dodo. That's what you've got. Sorry, that's what everybody has? No one has son of his uncle?
No one has son of his uncle.
Oh, Dodo?
Oh, yeah, you all have Dodo as a name, so we have to come back to that. Control yourselves, guys. This isn't kindergarten anymore. So we're gonna have to look at this a little bit closer. Ish Yisachar. Hang on. Ish Yisachar. Sorry. So that's what we'll have to. That's, hang on. We'll discuss. Ish Yisachar. He is from Yisachar. We usually like the shevet of Yisachar. Yisachar is supposed to be the source of Talmidei Chachamim. It's supposed to be a nice, wonderful, peace-like tribe. V'yoshev b'Shamir b'Har Ephraim, and he lives on Shamir, on Har Ephraim. Shamir is understood in the commentaries generally to be a place, and especially because of the next pasuk, you'll see that that Shamir is a place on Har Ephraim. What is Har Ephraim to us? We've seen Har Ephraim many times now. Right? The central site. It's where everything takes place. Yeshua's last speech is to the Jews. Har Ephraim. Yeshua is buried. Har Ephraim. The city of Shechem is on Har Ephraim. It's a central place for everything. The only problem we have with it is what?
It's
a very centrally located place. I can show you a map of the Dot Mikra probably, but what's the problem? In this pasuk, right here, there should be a problem. Think about it. Yeah. Har Ephraim. Where do you think Har Ephraim is? Which shaman has Har Ephraim? Thank you. Right? Who's buried in Grand Slam? Here's Har Ephraim. We've got a Har Ephraim map. If you see this map, here's the Kinneret up here, the Yarden coming down. This is Har Ephraim. I don't know if this is helpful at all. Certainly not for those who can't see it.
Is Har Ephraim actually...
Here's the Kinneret, Yarden running south, and this area is marked Har Ephraim here.
So it's like a range of mountains?
In general, Har often is a range of mountains. It's not one mountain. So yes, it's a mountainous area. He's from Yisachar. Why is he on a frame of mountain? And the answer may be because that's Washington D.C. That's where everybody goes, or Ottawa. Vayishvotes Yisrael esrim v'shalosh shana. He judges Israel for 23 years. Vayamas, and he dies. Vayikaver b'Shamir. And he's buried in Shamir, which again is why we think Shamir must be a place, because otherwise, what is it? But one problem we have to ask here is...
We don't know anything he did.
What's he doing here? Another problem is, we don't know anything. I mean, what's the one thing we... We know he did two things. I shouldn't say that. We know he did two things, besides dying.
But he's the son of...
He judged us.
And he sat in...
Well, he judged, right.
And he...
ruled for 23 years.
No.
Maybe at Ben Dodo... The sentence before is about Yotam. So is it Ben Dodo, son of the...
There's another antecedent in between.
Of Yotam.
Who's in between?
Abimelech.
So we have to see, is he related to Abimelech? Which would raise Diane's question of, wait a minute, he's from Yisachar, Abimelech is not. No. Hold off on that question. But he also did something else.
Do you think he's related to Abimelech?
If Dodo is Abimelech's uncle. He rose after Abimelech to save Israel. Tola ben Pua, the son of Abimelech's uncle. In other words, he's Abimelech's first cousin.
I don't see really the problem of him being from Yisachar, because if the president moves to Washington, D.C., right? He could be the leader, the next Shabbat can be from anywhere, and he's just coming to the central
and
area.
And that could well be the answer. But first, what else did he do?
Moshiach
Israel. He saved us. From whom?
Ourselves.
Well,
no such luck.
It's true.
From our men.
From Abimelech. Abimelech's dead.
Where did he
start? Didn't you just tell us?
To save history.
Midian's done. Midian is toast. We put ourselves for the last parak.
Yeah.
We've been busy fighting ourselves. So who is he saving us from? But the word Lahushia is a military word. That's not for,
Maybe you make peace between each other.
Right. So let's backtrack. He's on Har Ephraim. The Dot Mikra says simply, and I think it makes sense, that it's the southern part of Yisachar. Meaning when you look at the map, Yisachar is north of Ephraim. And so the southern portion of Yisachar must extend onto Har Ephraim. It's called Har Ephraim because Ephraim has most of it.
Menashe is kind of in there.
Menashe is in between?
Yeah.
So I don't trust any map, so I'm okay with that.
Okay.
No, meaning we've seen so many maps when we went through Yehoshua and the division of the land, and we saw so many maps that had different problems with them.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that. It's weird, but I'm okay with it. Rabbi Bernhofer in Big Day Sheish says, as we suggested, it's the center of Jewish life. Even after Shem is destroyed, it's still the center of Jewish life. Fine. We are being saved from somebody. The Da'at Mikra, Professor Eli Tzur, just kind of shrugs and says, we're saved from someone. And you sort of wonder, is that, if you take the Da'at Mikra's approach, that we're trying to show that there were many shoftim and they did things that are just not so important for you. So, okay, so it's interchangeable with another shoftim. Fill in the blank. This is the enemy he defeated. And move on.
Years. It was a long time compared to some of them.
Yes. The name itself is an interesting name. What does Tola mean? It's a pasuk, ha'emunim alei Tola. So Tolat is a worm, which I actually was wondering, because the Shamir is supposed to be this worm that they use in the Beis HaMikdash, but yeah, I couldn't find anybody who actually moved with that one.
Work?
Sorry?
Work? Yeah,
isn't
it like labor? Like,
work? On your mind?
Like
toil. That's what I'm thinking.
Toil.
Also. And I'm wondering if I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's English. So tola is understood to be some kind of a fabric that's like very soft and luxurious. Like a silky or something that's luxurious and soft, which goes well with pu'ah, because pu'ah is with an aleph is a cosmetic. It's like a istis and pua are mentioned together in the Gemara. It's some kind of a rouge type of a thing, so or something. I don't know. So tola ben pua in that sense suggests an element of wealth.
It's flesh.
You expect me to know? It suggests a certain degree of luxury and wealth, which is going to fit very well with the next shofet after him, who also is going to be wealthy. So that actually may be one message that's here. But there's something else which I found. Rabbi Bechofer made reference to this, and it was fascinating. Yisachar had four sons. Well, I gave you the pasuk. Gracious Mem Vav Yud Gimel. Because you haven't taken my advice and started learning leaning yet. So. Tola and Puva are the first two sons listed for Yisachar.
It's possible the same way.
So that part I caught. Sorry. But no, it's not the same. It can't be the same one, bless you. But these are names from family history. These are names from family history. But now, who are the other two? Yov and Shimron. Anything there resonate in this pasuk that we have of Tola and Shamir? But what do you do with Yov? Well, the answer is jump to Bamidbar, Perek Chavav, Pasuk Chav Gimel, Chav Dalet, which is another census. And there you find the four sons of Yisachar, Tola, Puva, Yashuv, and Shimron.
That's weird.
Suddenly it's Yashuv. Right, so why the name changes, I can come back to in a minute. But Yashuv, now go back to our pasuk here, Vehu Yoshev Bishamir. In other words, all four of the names of Yisachar's sons are found here with Tola ben Puva, or Puah. So what this means, I have no idea.
That's cool.
Just a cool but it's just name. Very interesting to see them there. I mean, you could suggest maybe that means that he sort of encapsulates all of the traits of Yisachar because all four of the sons are mentioned here with him. Or I suggest simply that the author of the Sefer, meaning Shmuel, puts in the allusion to the idea that every shevet is represented by its shofet. Right, which we talked about, that every shevet has a shofet, so he is representative of the shevet, and therefore, look, we're going to stick in all four, we'll find a way to fit in all four names. Not that he wasn't really named Tola ben Puah, he is, but throwing in this business of Yoshev Bishamir Bahar Ephraim, that's put in there specifically in order to get the last two. Now, you asked how Yov became Yashuv, so there's a very weird medrash on this. like super weird. The lead Greek god is named what?
Zeus.
What do the Romans call him?
Jupiter.
Or one other name? But he's not being called Jupiter, he's called, all starts with a J. No, that's different. Jove.
No.
Right? You never heard that? Jove?
No.
Yes. Like by Jove, when someone says by Jove. Yes. Yeah. So sometimes he's called Jove. So there's this very strange medrash that says that because they were worshiping a deity called Jove, the family said, you know what, we're not going to do Jove anymore. We're going to call him Yashuv instead of Jove. Oh, it gets even weirder. Where did the Shin come from? What tribe is he from?
Yisachar.
Yisachar has an extra sin. Because we say Yisachar, we don't say Yisachar. Mm-hmm. So that sin comes from Yisachar and becomes Yashuv. And wait for it. This is why some people have the practice, this actually is an existing thing, that when they elain, but until they get to Parshas Pinchas, where he's Yashuv, they'll say Yisachar. And then in Pinchas, they'll switch over to say Yisachar, because now he lost the letter. It's a very, very strange thing. I don't want to tell you, because you'll make fun of him. But that's the idea.
But the Roman name Jove came years and years later. I don't understand.
Sorry?
He came years later, Jove.
Right. So that's the thing. It's clearly anachronistic. No one's worshipping Jove at that stage in history. It's clearly anachronistic. The whole thing is very strange. I hope
the kind of like a premonition of the Greek mythology.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close. Unless you're going to tell me the Greek mythology came from roots that were, you know, earlier and someone had it earlier. Maybe. I didn't look it up. So maybe. Maybe. The whole thing is very strange. But anyway, going back to where we were. You have Tola ben Puva. Ben Pu, I should say, Ben Dodo. So either Dodo is a name, which is what Rashi says, in which case he's actually getting a two-layer lineage. In other words, whereas other ones we just say his name and his father's name, here we're getting two layers in, suggesting that his father and his grandfather were known figures. Well, like we don't, but in his day, or in the day of Shmuel, they would have been well known. The Gemara says that anytime you see a Navi mentioned with his father, that means that he and his father were both Nevi'im. So everybody knows these are important people. So it could be they were important people, which would then explain perhaps why I need to list him in Sefer Shoftim. Right? It's not just he was a Shofate, but he was a Shofate. He was from a line of leaders. Could be. That's one approach. The other approach is Radak. And here I brought it for you on the sheet in number 4. He says, Kach Shemo, meaning the first approach is the name was Dodo. But in some editions in the Targum, it's Bar Ach Avuhi, the son of the brother of his father, meaning Avimelech's father. Vimkenu Yirtzalomar Ben Dod Avimelech. That makes him Avimelech's cousin, which then the Malbim notes is a problem because he's from Yisachar, and Avimelech is from Menashe. And we know who Avimelech's father was. His father was Gideon, who's from the family of Abiezer. It doesn't really work if you're going to read that. Nonetheless, it's a suggestion for Dodo. Either way, we emphasize where he lives. Shamir on Har Ephraim. Keep that in mind. He judges in the mold of Otniel ben Kenaz, who we were told judged, in the mold of Devorah, who judged. Some of the Shoftim, we didn't find him actually judging. He never said by Yishpot. But for him, there is judging that is happening. We didn't see it in Gideon. We didn't see it in Avimelech. But that's the introduction to Tola. And not just the introduction, that's it. And the epilogue also. But there are two more notes that you have to make on this person, Tola, which are very important. First of all, one throwback to Avimelech that's fascinating. We had this discussion, which I alluded to in the beginning today, of whether Avimelech counts as a shofate or not. Right? Abarbanel said shoftim are wonderful people, and Avimelech is a shofate, and he killed his brothers before he became a shofate. not explaining, yeah, but he also killed all those people afterwards and was bloodthirsty and so on. That Abarbanel doesn't say to you, oh, and that's okay because X.
He was self-appointed, right? Weren't the other ones
So that was a question. Take a look at number 5. This is a radak that we saw before, which supports what Ora is saying. Ulefisha malach me'atzmo, because he reigned on his own. V'lo malach al kol Yisrael, and not over all Israel. Levicha amar vayasar. That's why the verb that was used was vayasar, suggesting he used power over them. He compelled them to be under him. V'lo amar vayishpot, and it didn't say he judged. Ki lo halach b'derech tova, because he did not follow a good path. V'lo hachzir es Yisrael l'mutav, he didn't bring Israel to good conduct. So in other words, I quoted that when we learned about Abimelech initially and said, this seems to say he's not a shofet, he's not on our list, get him off the list. But then there's Radak on our perek, and he picks up on the key word in our opening sentence, Vayakam acharei Avimelech. He arose after Avimelech. I know he's after Avimelech, because Avimelech was the previous perek. Why did you need to tell me that? So on this, Radak says, Hebrew's on one side, English is on the other, Gam Avimelech hushias Yisrael. Avimelech also fought wars to save Israel. V'avo pi shalom nizkar, granted that they're not mentioned in the book, kevan sha'amar acharei Avimelech, since it says that Tola arose after Avimelech to save Israel, nira shegam hu hoshia Yisrael mi'arei v'hem, it appears that Avimelech also saved the Jews from their enemies. V'ilu lochen, if it were not so, lo haya omar acharei, he wouldn't have said he arose after Avimelech to save Israel, v'lo haya nimnev shavtei Yisrael, and he, Avimelech, would not have been counted among the Shoftim. And it wouldn't have said that he mastered Israel. In other words, Radak is now playing a different tune. Radak says Avimelech is indeed a Shofet. Well, unless you're going to say that what he said in the previous parak was simply to say he's not a good guy, so we don't use the term Vayishvot. But the fact that he's a self-made man does not disqualify him from being called a shofet. Even though he did it in this horrible way that he did, the definition of a shofet per Radak is a rescuer of Israel from their enemies. That's the way that Radak defines it. Okay, so that was one thing that I found was interesting. Contrast that, by the way, with Malbim, who says that's not what acharei means at all. He says it's just the opposite. Ki Avimelech, in source number 7, Ki Avimelech lo hoshia osam, rak hister aleam. Avimelech did not rescue them, he only reigned over them. In other words, he arose after Avimelech to rescue Israel because Avimelech didn't do it.
But Avimelech was only 3 years. It sounds like this guy comes up, he stays as old, he's ruling 23 years. It sounds like there was some type of calm or, you know, peace in the land. Otherwise, they would have overturned him. I don't know. Like, he saved them, and then the other guy comes for also 20-some years. Like, this is like 50 years here before Yiftach.
Yeah.
But they have these two
guys. Well, we have to talk about that, about the pre-Yiftach thing. But the point right now, at any rate, I mean, the added note is, so maybe Avimelech is a shofet. Maybe Avimelech did fight wars to save us, and we just got this rotten story about him, because that's what, you know, Shmuel wants to tell us about. But in terms of what we're stressing in Tola, right, this person who has two psukim to cover his 23 years, he's a good shofet. He rescues us from our enemies, he does his business, he doesn't start fights, he doesn't kill people, you know, for nothing. Just a good all-around shofet.
Well, we don't.
Correct.
Yeah, there's nothing to it.
Correct.
Your typical,
what, the papers could write about the weather.
Maybe what the prophet was supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Right. So, Dr. Rosenson, though, picks up on something else in number 8. He says, the key here is the geography. Right? We emphasize where he lived, and we emphasize where he was buried as well, for that matter. But keep in mind, you just told me that Yisachar's southern border on Har Ephraim borders Menashe. Who was from Menashe? Gidon and Avimelech, right? Good. So take a look at number 8. He says, Nir'at Epho, Shakasu Bahadgisho Esat Sadha Geography. If you want to write that word, there you go. Besipuram Shal Shnei Ha'ishim. Bikesh Ben Hashar Lermoz Al Hakalut Hayachasit Bani Tanaya Lermod Et Lekach Avimelech Al Burio. He says, the Pasuk, by emphasizing geography when it tells of these two men, tries to explain to us or to hint to us how easy it should have been to learn lessons from what happened with Avimelech. They're right there. He's on the spot where everything happened. Mitzayena Kasuv Shoshias Yisrael. The text notes that he saved Israel, he rescued Israel. Lefiani is Daiti, so Dr. Rosenstein says, in my humble opinion, Al Reka Sipuro Shal Avimelech Yesh Lekach Mashmaut Rabbah. He says, this is really very meaningful against the background of Avimelech's story. It's saying this is a return to judges post Avimelech, like what Malbim was saying, that Avimelech did not rescue Israel. So in other words, we've gone off the rails, right? We had good ones. Daniel was good, Shamgar was good, Ehud was good, Devorah was good. Then Gideon didn't really want to be in this position, but fine, he did what he was supposed to do, and then Avimelech took things entirely sideways, and then we come to Tola, in the geographic place where Avimelech was, getting the people back on a proper path. We have 23 solid years under Tola. Got it? That's what Dr. Rosenstein sees as emphasizing here with this geography. So now let's see what happens with Yair HaGiladi.
I would say that's an achievement.
Yes, not a small thing.
People named Yair.
Right. Vayakam acharav Yair. I think people don't because of the Tolaat association, the worm thing. You know, it's just. Yeah. Vayakam acharav Yair HaGiladi. Yes. The Vayakam acharav Yair HaGiladi. So after him arose Yair of Gilad, Yair HaGiladi. He is going to be from what Shevet?
Menashe.
Menashe, right. Gilad is in Menashe, east of the Yardin. She's got like 100 points already. Your team is insane. Okay. Vayakam acharav Yair HaGiladi. So Yair arises after him. Vayishpot es Yisrael esrimushtaim shana. 22 years. And he's also Vayishpot. He's also judging. Vayilo shloshim banim. He had 30 sons. Rochvim al shloshim ayarim. They rode on 30 ayarim. Out of curiosity, how do your books translate ayarim?
White colts.
Colts.
White colts.
White colts.
White colts. I don't have white colts.
It doesn't say white here, yeah. So, one view of ayarim is that they are indeed supposed to be fine horses. Fine young horses. Even Rashi says that they're fine horses.
An illustrator.
I think that's with an aleph, isn't it? Would be illustration with an aleph, I think.
Huh?
Aleph Yud Vav Resh, I think so.
He says young donkeys.
Right, so yours follows Radak. Radak says that they are young donkeys. Yeah, I think I even brought it on the sheet. Did I bring it on the sheet? Yeah, number 12. Okay. Radak says, V'ha'ayar hu'achamor hanar, young donkey. Kamo Osri Laget Venira. I mean, Tzedat Zion is coming about 500-600 years after Radak. So I'll take the Radak. Presumably that's what he did. But Osri Lagefen Iro, which is the bracha that's given by Yaakov, he ties to the grapevine his Ayar, and Va'al Ayar Ben Asonos, which is Zechariah's pasuk, about riding on an Ayar. If I remember correctly, that's the Mashiach pasuk, one of them. So he says maybe these were choice in those lands. In other words, when you say he had 30 kids and they all rode these animals, it's trying to say they had luxury. These were good animals. But that also could be because those who go to sea from those lands from afar, they call horses ayarim. So in other words, it could be that these are horses. He's fine either way. Both of these are potential translations. Either way, look at the pasuk again. 30 sons, they ride on 30 of these fine animals, ushloshim ayarim lahem, and they have 30 cities, one per son, in other words. Lahem yikru'u chavos yair, those cities are called chavot yair, ad hayom hazeh, until this very day. A chava is like a fortress. Sorry?
nowadays is a farm.
A farm? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, how do they translate him there?
Village.
Village. Okay. Don Mikra thinks it's a fortress. Ah, so Nanette asks, is this the same Chavod Yair that we are familiar with from B'chumash? That's a very good question we have to come back to. But these are called Chavod Yair Ad Hayom Hazeh, to this very day, Asher Be'eretz HaGilad, which are in the land of Gilad. Vayomos Yair, Yair died, Vayikaver BeKamon, and he was buried in a place called Kamon. Okay, so what questions come to mind as you read these three psukim? Because now we're done with Yair as well. 22 years, just like that.
And it sounds almost like a limerick, I was saying, like a poem. Like 30 sons and 30 donkeys, or 30 horses and 30 cities. Like, what is that? Like,
yeah. And it's funny, because I can't find anybody who does anything with the 30, except the Big Day Sheish, Rebbe Hafer, who does all these deeper levels and reads of what 30 symbolizes. 30 symbolizes completion, all sorts of layers upon layers. But on a very simple, straightforward level, there's got to be something in terms of 30, but I can't think what it is, especially because 30 is going to show up again in the time of Yiftach. We're not done with 30.
But it's such a contrast with 70 that...
So it's sort of scaled down?
30 that...
No,
yeah,
but everyone has cities and horses.
Yeah.
Right, so they're flourishing. Like, it seems there's like no controversy, there's no killing, nobody's out to be the...
Seems like
very different from...
But Tobin rules by himself, it seems.
Yeah.
And then this guy...
He has his kids.
Yeah.
Could be. The not to mention, no one mentioned it, the play on words is cute, no?
Yeah,
Ayarim. Ayarim, right? This is the way that you'll find things work in Tanakh. I want to come back to it in a little bit, but it's it's a very artistic way to do it. Yeah, usually we do Arim rather than Ayarim, right?
It's an interesting contrast, because after Gidon came up in Melech, right? So here we have this other Shafet, and Gidon had 70 sons, blah, 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 and Abimelech took over. So Gidon has these 30 sons, nothing.
Nobody
killed
anybody.
You mean Yair? Yair has a 30. Yeah, sure, yeah, right, and everything seems to be, you know, more or less okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a funny, yeah, focus on the affluence.
Yes, the focus on the wealth is striking here. And I think that's a major point here.
Gidon had 70, so right, because he had 12 wives, 4 of 12, you know, we were okay with that. So this, I mean, we don't know how many wives he had.
We don't know how many wives Gidon had either. I think we just hypothesized, like, how many he would take. I don't think we actually had a source for saying that Gidon had 12.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was just you know, a legal estimate of what it should be.
Sorry.
18.
No, he went with 18.
He said he was allowed 18.
Yeah. Maybe. So, take a look at Radak in number 9, please, because I think this is a key. Radak says, Sipur zeh, Lahudia sibas heyoso shofet, higadol haya v'nichbad ba'osher u'banim v'chavod. This is explaining why he was a judge. That's why we learn about his kids.
But don't we usually see the excessive wealth as a negative for him?
Yes. He gets a position of power because of his wealth, and indeed it will be a negative. That's where we're going.
Well, not negative.
Hang on. There's time yet.
Well,
I got 2 minutes.
But he's done it.
Why would wealth matter? Why would that be a factor in him being chosen? Meaning, if you or I were to fix that, we would look for status symbols. If God is appointing the Shoft team,
because Radak already told us that Abimelech appointed himself,
yeah, right? But
so that's the answer. Radak is alleging that Yair gets his position, whether personally or by popular acclaim, because everyone looks at him and says, "Look, he's got this massive family. They have a lot of cities and animals, and that's the way he reads it."
It's the same as with Trump. People said, "Oh, look, he's got all these billions of dollars, and
not allowed to bring that up.
He's such a great businessman. He must be a great leader."
So anyway,
he was also disappointed.
So So the cities, these cities, Rashi interestingly says, Ir refers to a village that is exposed, that doesn't have a wall. I wonder if that's Ir to be exposed, like Irva, that kind of etymology. But it's clear that we're using Ayarim like this, and we're not saying things like Arim.
As a village.
Yeah, well, Ir is. That's a more modern word. That's a more modern word, yeah. It's meant to catch the ear. I brought you a source on the sheet from Ibn Ezra in Bereishis. People often catch this. The fact that we're told, in the end of the second chapter in Bereishis, we're told that Adam and Chava were Erumim. That they weren't embarrassed, they're not wearing anything, but they're okay with it. And then the opening pasuk of the next parak is V'hanachash haya arum, which doesn't mean the snake isn't wearing clothing, but it means the snake is clever. It's a play on words. So Ibn Ezra says in number 10, V'al tisma b'avor hayos arum achar erumim, don't be surprised by having arum after erumim. They mishnei ta'amim, even though they have two different meanings. Ki be'ele hatzachus ha'belashon. That's purity of language. It means that this is a refined way to speak. Kumo, he gives you an example from Shimsho. Bilchi ha'chamor chamor chamorotayim. Right, with the jaw of a donkey chamor, piles upon piles, chamor chamorotayim, like chamorim chamorim with the tzvardeya in Egypt. So the word has two different meanings. But it's juxtaposed poetically. V'chein, and he quotes our pasuk, al shloshim ayarim u'shloshim ayarim lahem. Same idea over here. It's a poetic thing. What I find interesting about that is that it leads to the question, which is sort of always floating in the air regarding how I translate and how I comment on psukim that I read. Meaning, there is a school of thought which most of you were probably raised on in school, called omnisignificance. They didn't necessarily use the word, but I guarantee you they taught it. Omnisignificance means what it sounds like. Everything is significant. There's not a single extra letter. If one word is used versus another word, it's meant to teach me a lesson. It's for, bless you, it's for a halacha. It's to hint for something. There's nothing that is superfluous in, at least in Chumash, if not in Tanakh as a whole. Right? That's certainly what I learned in school. However, the Gemara itself notes that sometimes the Torah will use synonyms for something. Instead of using a certain word, it'll use another word that has the same meaning, because na'e yoser, it sounds nicer to use this. It's more poetic. And don't try to read in extra meanings, it's not. It's just, it sounds better this way. So for example, when the Torah presents the laws of lending on interest, it uses the word neshach, and it uses the word tarbit. And the Gemara goes into, are these two different things? Is one the impact on the borrower? Is one the impact on the lender? And different ways to interpret it, but one approach there is simply, the Torah used the word neshach over and over and over again, or tabit over and over again, it would have been repetitive. So sometimes it says this way, sometimes that way, it sounds nicer. And ditto here, ayarim, don't try to read deeper meaning, it's just, it sounds cool. It's poetic.
And one's written by God, and one's written by man.
Well, that's only because you're a Navi, but you'll find it in Chumash regarding neshach and tarbit.
Right.
That's God. And even here it's Ruach HaKodesh. Even here it's Ruach HaKodesh. I think that Ibn Ezra's point is an interesting point, and it raises this bigger question of, when you read a pasuk, do you have to find a meaning for every extra vav? Do you have to look for something? You know, Rashi himself, who is known for finding meaning for everything, will on occasion in the Chumash say, yeah, that vav doesn't really belong, but you find usages like this. Look in Parshas Truma for one interesting example. But the number 30 is going to mean something somehow. I just don't know what yet. But it's going to show up with Yivtzan again in Perek Yudbet. Okay. Cities. The cities are named Chavot Ya'ir. So this raises a question. Nanette asked, we have cities called Chavot Ya'ir already. They were in Chumash, as a matter of fact. So, and they were in this place. They're in the Gilad. They were named Chavot Ya'ir in the Chumash because they were conquered by Ya'ir ben Menashe, right? The original Ya'ir. This is not the same Ya'ir. everyone takes pains to say, all the commentators take pains to say, we would not think that this is the same Yair as back then. He'd be a few hundred years old. Granted that Pinchas is, Pinchas can be, but only one Pinchas. Mm-hmm.
What story is it?
When they fight their wars before they cross the Yarden. So Yair ben Menashe conquers this area from the Amori, and the cities are called Chavot Yair al Shemo, on his name. So the question then is, so why is it that this happens? So I gave you a reference. I gave you a reference in 11 to a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, which is the Da'at Mikra's explanation. The Da'at Mikra says in that pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, we find that the original cities were captured. So in other words, what Da'at Mikra suggests is that the originals were captured, and these are other cities. They're not. It's not a recapture of those, right? No, but now Yair captures new cities, and he names them Chavot Yair, like those. Like those originals.
Doesn't it say there also that they were called Chavot Yair Ad Yom Hazeh?
Yes. So. Ad Yom Hazeh there, though, is not Ad Yom Hazeh here.
Oh.
Right. These are different yoms, so to speak. The but yes, it sounds strange, no? Abarbanel takes an entirely different view. Abarbanel says they're the same cities. It's the same cities, and yes, you're right. In Chumash, it said they're called that because of that Yair. And here, if you look carefully, it just says these are called Chavod Yair and Ayam Hazeh. It doesn't say that there's a new reason for it. So he says it's the same as those cities. Don't get hung up on it.
But do we know that there were 30 of them before?
We're not given a number. Maybe he expanded, he added some.
Like the coincidence of it being for his 30 years, same number of cities? Or?
What do you mean?
Like if it's the same cities as before, but now he's telling us that there's exactly 30 of them because that's how many kids he had.
Oh, we don't know how many cities there were before.
Right, so what's the chances that
maybe he got the cities and then the kids?
Oh, that's right. They said we need 30 kids. We don't need 31.
Right.
If we have 31, we're going to have to email us for it all over again.
So we had 30 kids. Like, how do you know that? You know, right.
Okay, so, and maybe he added to Chavot Yair. Maybe he added additional towns.
Yeah.
That we don't know. But the upshot of it is that this fellow Yair, this Shofet Yair, is a wealthy man. He's in control of this area. He names these cities Chavot Yair, and we're going to have to stop short of Dr. Rosenson's point that he learns from this. So we'll have to pick up with that, God willing, next week, and then we'll get a better picture of what's going on in this parak, and then we'll get into the introduction to Yifnach. Okay, thank you.